Should we start? Yesterday we talked about Langstroth's diagonalization. And today we're going to talk about something else. So eventually I'd like to explain to you what and how Monte Carlo methods work. And there are a number of related methods. But before we get there, I have to talk a little bit about random numbers. And how they work. And surprisingly, if you actually have access to reliable random numbers, then you can design algorithms that can do quite powerful things for you. And we will talk a little bit about that. So, suppose we were to design something that would produce random numbers. Could you think of a process that you would call completely random? Nobody knows anything that's random? What?
When you have to decay.
Yes, yes. So that's, of course, one suggestion. And apart from the fact that you probably don't want to distribute radioactive material all over the world whenever you want to do scientific calculations, is there a problem if we wanted to generate random numbers using something like radioactive decay? Suppose you were selling product, what would you need to do that? You would need to design a detector, right? And then you're suddenly stuck with the problem that you would have to detect a radioactive decay or something like this, and then you're confronted with all kinds of problems. And the most straightforward of that is that you can not design a detector that's going to be 100% efficient. And then let's forget about the problems with doing quantum measurements. So if we go and look at physical phenomena, then the problem is really there, that it is difficult to come up with something that is regarded really as random. The other example is, of course, that you might go out and look at complex phenomena, count the cars on the 403, and so forth. If we wanted random numbers, then we could somehow find the physical process or something, and then harvest them, as you might call it. Even though we would think that that would be very easy, then there as we can see, there are two problems with this. We would need a process that where we can assure that there's no physical correlations in there, and then we need to measure them or harvest them in some reliable way. Other way that we could get at something that would be really truly random is that we could just buy random numbers. And that sounds like a stupid thing to do, but you could easily imagine that you just get a big honking DVD and then work a long time fill it up with random numbers of high quality that you had gotten from somewhere, and that would solve the problem of distributing radioactive material all over the place, right? And you can actually do that, but the amount of random numbers that you would need for a typical simulation is huge. And today, this is likely not feasible. But this has become a real problem, and there are actually a number of other techniques that you can try to exploit. And the if you go and look at your computer here, then there's a device. It's called random. And the idea behind that is that if you look at the internal registers and cache on the chip, then you could imagine or try to convince yourself that the state of the bits here on your chip for all practical purposes could be regarded as random. And so in the current Linux distribution, and we just checked this on your computer, there is actually a device that's called random. And it what it does what it's called entropy gathering. And this is something that's evolving. So I haven't looked at this in detail, but when I checked last night, things might have changed since maybe it was solved overnight. Then I think the current state is that using these devices are relatively too slow because the amount of entropy that you're accumulating is not enough to exploit this for a real random number generator. But people have been working along these ideas, and there's a project that's called Habitch, and that's hardware volatile entropy gathering and expansion. And you can read all about it in HTTP here, :// and it's a French project, so www and .irisa.france and something else. I'm not going to write out the whole thing because it is actually quite long, but you can just search for Habitch here and then look for the site that's in France. And what they've done is precisely to exploit these ideas, and as far as I can tell, you can actually download a working source code that would actually gather entropy from looking at the internal state of your computer and exploit that. The idea behind this and why I mentioned these efforts is that they're somewhat different from the other methods that I'm going to be telling you about, which are random number generators. Because here we're looking at a state of something, in this case the hardware that you're actually sitting in front of, and then we're going to say that, you know, your network traffic combined with whatever you're typing does actually mashes everything up, so we can, for practical purposes, consider the state of the CPU and the cache registers as being random. Whether you actually want to believe that is another question, but there's been there's an ongoing effort into this, and likely in the near future you can get fairly reliable random numbers or random number generators that is basically harvested from the underlying hardware. Okay, I actually believe there are a couple of these devices, and the interest is actually also from cryptographic purposes, whether you can use this to do cryptography or not. So instead, what we're going to be looking at is what I call the RNGs. And one should precede them with the keyword sudo, because I can actually show you the actual source code for quite a few of them, even though I don't think I'm going to do that. Once you have the source code, it obviously means that there's a deterministic process going on, and that's a contradiction in terms. How can you design a deterministic algorithm that produces something that's random? And of course, that's not possible. But for practical purposes, you can get close enough that these pseudo number generators here will mimic a true random number generators. So let me just point out a few things here. Most of them, they generate 32 random bits. And that may or may not then be converted into a random number on the interval from either. So it's converted to a random number on either the interval from 0 to 1. I write this so that 0 is inclusive, 1 is excluded, or both of them excluded here, or both of them are included, or 0 is excluded and 1 is included. And you need to know which one of these four cases that you're looking at, because quite often what you're going to be doing is you will generate a random number to take you to a position on some grid, right? And whether 0 or 1 are inclusive or not, that will determine whether you can hit inside or outside the grid. And if you have a large grid, before these boundary cases occur, that could actually be several hours. So you will see the strange behavior that your program will be running entirely correctly for 10 hours, and suddenly you'll get a segmentation fault. And believe me, that's very hard to debug. And it's all because somewhere in the hidden in the documentation, maybe it actually will tell you that, oh, by the way, one, the exact number one is not excluded. It can actually occur, right? So beware of this. What else was I going to say here? The other very important thing here, in many cases, the documentation, whether you for which of these four cases you have, is actually not 100% correct. The other important thing is that you may, from the internet, download a code that people worked very hard to make sure generate 32 random bits, right? But then it so happens that when you do this, you also bought the latest dashing, smashing laptop like this one, and that for some reason have decided to go up to 64-bit, right? And so when you compile it, maybe inherently you're working with integers that have 64 bits. Of course, everything will still compile, but the random numbers will look random, but will no longer be as random as they should be. If you take something off the internet here, you need to worry about these portability issues. And in general, one should worry quite a bit about moving a working random number generator between platforms, because you need to read the documentation and make sure that things didn't go wrong. And in particularly, if you move up to sort of high-end systems like Cray's and so forth. Yes?
How do you measure randomness?
That's the other... That I was going to ask you guys that. So how do we measure it? So can anybody think of... a good suppose I have something now. I've written my fancy code here, and I claim that it's just dead on. Everything is random. How would you check that I was right? Yeah. So we can run statistical tests, right? The obvious one, for instance, would be I would just plot them, right? The first thing I would do would be just to plot them. So on the interval here from 0 to 1, if this here is 1 and that is 0, then you want to see how many hits I get in a given bin. So if this here is truly random, then I should see some, if I make a histogram of it, then it should be fairly uniform, right? So if I claim this is uniform, then the simplest thing I could do is to plot them. Then you can actually, you can pull out your statistics book, and then you can run all the tests that you can think of from your statistics book. Would that convince you guys entirely? Well, so how about I have designed a random number generator, but for some reason the two least significant bits are always one. In other words, they're never changed. Once I convert this to a uniform integer between 0 and 1, would that show up in any kind of these statistical tests? I think that the answer is likely not, right? So the other class here of tests that you can do, I can say, oh, well, maybe I should forget about these uniform numbers. Maybe I should go up and look at bit patterns, right? I could look at tests that you would never think about in statistical analysis. I could look at, is bit number 13 correlated with bit number 5? So imagine that my random number generator, for whatever strange reason, has 100% correlation between bit number 13 and bit number 5. that would be hard to detect, right? And once you get going with these tests, then you can conceive of quite a few of them. So in order honor of Bruce Willis, there's a famous suite of tests that most modern-day generators are supposed to pass, and it's called the Die-Hard tests here. And I believe it's Marsaglio that started designing them, and it's sort of a suite of tests. The last time I checked, it was about 28 different tests, but these tests, you keep adding to them. When they initially started doing this, then a huge number of the commonly used random number generators, of course, failed those tests. That was a problem. There is a famous PRL from, I believe, 1991, where they decided to do Monte Carlo calculations on the Ising model. So they had fancy algorithms for doing this, and they were going to do some high precision calculations. And so they choose the Ising model because there's a lot of data available. And then their program wasn't working. And actually, what wasn't working is that their data was about 5 or 6 error bars away from where it should be. And that took quite a bit more work then, and finally it was traced down to basically the random number generator that they were using. Even though it was supposed to be a fairly high quality random number generator, it was not sufficient. And eventually it was realized that a number of data that had been published were had errors associated with the random number generators used. That led to sort of an increased effort in designing modern random number generators. So there are tests here, and some of them, there are actually a couple of more sites that you can go to. And if you get into this and you want to make your name as having created a new random number generator, then you need to show that it'll pass these tests. And some of them are not obvious. Can you think about a very simple test? Well, that's a leading question. Let me just tell you the answer instead. The one question that you can ask here, in a true random process, a number, and in this case, think a 32-bit pattern here, it can occur twice in a row. Right? If you think about a random process, then it's possible that I do an observation, and then immediately after it, the probability of observing exactly the same thing is non-zero. It may be very small, but it's technically non-zero. And so think about this. Because we're gonna discuss some of the random number generators that people have used. Unfortunately, today they're less in use, they will definitely violate this criterion very bluntly. The other thing is, of course, that suppose I show you a plot of random points in the plane, then visually, after with a little bit of experience, it actually, for most people, becomes possible to pick out the random pattern among patterns with correlations, and that's because true randomness, precisely, true randomness is not uniform, right? There's a lumpiness to true randomness that comes from this property that it's not just going to be every point equidistant and nicely distributed all over the whole place. When we look at this uniform interval here, I'm not going to get this point, that point, and everything just nicely spaced between them. They will lump together and have lumpiness on all scales, and that's the nature of randomness. So if you make a plot in the XY plane, you can actually see that if it looks too nice, then likely it's not random, right? Okay, so I just wanna show you a few random number generators that we can talk about. And they're not very fancy. The first class of random number generators are what are called linear congruential generators. And they're very simple because I take my random number that I know, let's call it ij, and again, we should think really about 32-bit integer patterns, and then just at the very end, we may convert it into a floating point. So for practical purposes, we think of the random number generators in terms of integers, even though that may not be how you use them. Yes? Congruential? Yes. And that just comes because I take the previous random number, multiply it by a constant A, then I add another constant to it, and then I do a mod. And so I do a modulus M. So the linear, that's just because this is a linear function, and then the congruential is because I do the mod there. One defines the usually this modulus here is maybe some 2 to the power 32 minus 1 maybe. The other thing is that when you design these generators, you want them to be very, very fast, right? So I cannot, it would be meaningless to define a random number generator that would exploit the error function, for instance, or some other horrible thing like a cosine or a sine. If you throw something like that into your generator, then it'll become so slow that it's not of any practical use here. So one talks about a period of these random number generators, it just means that if I start with a given ij, how many new random numbers can I generate before I happen on the same random number again? And if in this case for the linear congruential operator, I only have of the order of 2 to the 32 different numbers. How big a number is 2 to the 32? You're all sitting in front of computers, right? The Well, it used to be. Okay, so it is it bigger or smaller than the amount of people on the planet Earth? What? Yeah, it's smaller, and that's actually why one of the reasons that there are problems with the internet today, because the addressing system was set up so there's only 2 to the 32 addresses, because nobody could conceive that there would be need for anything more than that, right? And that's in excess of 4 billion. But each of you guys are probably already occupying at least 5 or 7 IP addresses. Which I don't know. Yeah. Well. Anyway, yeah. So this year is actually, you know, this may seem like a big number, but for a practical simulation, that's actually a very small number. So you would be running through quite a few of these. The reason why I'm mentioning this to you is that if you ever programmed in C, then there's a random number generator that's built into C, and that's actually of this form, and it's even defined in ANSI C here. So A is 11035155245. M here is 2 to the 32, and C, I always like that one. C is just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That probably took them a long time to come up with that, right? The end result is, of course, that this random number generator, even with these constants, is fairly low quality, and that was not realized because people. They just thought, well, you know, it's built into the compiler, so it's got to be good, right? But it wasn't. I want to show you a little example about how this works. So I'm gonna do my my little example here. So my RNG, and don't laugh. I'm going to take A equal to 3, C equal to 2, and then M equal to 32. And then I'm going to use this, right? In other words, I'm going to say that ij plus 1 here, it's going to be equal to 3ij plus 2 here, and then mod 32. So let's start the little game here. I start with 1. And then I multiply this by 3 and add 2 to it and do a mod 32. That takes me to 5. 5 here, that takes me to 17. Then 3 times 17, it's 51, 53, mod 32, that is 21. And then I'm gonna do a little arrow like this, because this indicates that there was a mod operation. Then we do 3 times 21, that's 63, 65, mod 32, that's 1. And for this linear congruential operator, once I hit the same integer again, then I'm just repeating, right? So this here, maybe we could say that 1, 2, 3, 4. So the period here is 4. If I go and look at 2, then that takes me to 8. 3 times 8 is 24. Takes me up to 26. Then I do 3 times 26 is 78 plus 2. That's 80. So I go to 16. From 16, I actually go to 18. And then from 18, I go to 24. And then to 10.
And after 10, then I magically hit 0, and then I go to 2. So maybe you would say that the period here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So we could say that the period here is 8. There are a couple of reasons why I show you this. The first thing is that the actual periodicity that you would get for your sequence, it depends on your starting number. So we would say that this here is an initialization. And I always do this exercise. I ask people to think of a random number of the integers between 1 to 10. And it turns out that a fairly significant majority will think of an odd number. So an odd number is more random than an even number, right? Just think about it. Whenever you do this, right, if what would you have answered? 7, right? And even a prime number, nothing can be more random than a prime number, right? These random number generators, unfortunately, humans come into play because we need to initialize them. So we provide what is often called a seed. And that was realized that having humans involved in the process was very bad because of these things first of all, you would choose a random number which was small. Then very biased, and even worse of all, people would never change it. So if you start using a random number generator today, likely changing the seed is very difficult. And it's very restrictive precisely for that reason. The other thing here you can see is if I look up to about this point, then things don't look so random. But once the arrows here start bending over, then things look more random. And that's sort of a general feature of these linear congruential operators, that once the modulus operation kicks in, then I'm actually multiplying up and then throwing out the low order bits. And so here we would say the mod m, it comes in. And really, if you want good properties of your random number generators, you should actually start with a seed that's fairly large. And of course, you don't want to memorize a 32-bit integer, right? You always want to memorize or think of something that is a small number. But in general, you should take something that's very large. So what you can amuse yourself of doing here is I can actually make a little list here of ij and then ij plus 1. And we have most of them or some of them on the blackboard already. If I had started with 0, then you can just see that the next one would be 2. If I start with 1, then the next one is 5. If I start with 2 here, then the next one is actually 8. If I start with 3, then I get 11. 4, I get 14. 5, I get 17. 6, I get 20. 7, I get 23. 8, I get 26. And 9, I get 29. And then 10 here, I get 1, right? No, I get 0. Yes. I continue this little game, and you can enumerate them. And I don't think I'm going to bother drawing the entire list here. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a little plot because, of course, I'm going to do a simulation of particles that are moving in a plane. And I'm going to do this so that I take two random numbers that would give me the x coordinate and the y coordinate. It's actually something that you would typically do in many, many simulations. You would take two subsequent numbers that are coming out of your generator to pick a point in the space. Now, that's very tricky because you're then relying on the fact that two subsequent numbers are entirely uncorrelated. What you can see here is that if you do this, then x and y for the first one would be 0, 2. And then the next one would be 8 and 26, right? So that would be 8 here, and then somewhere up here. And then after 26, I'm not writing it out, but it would actually be 16 and 18. So I guess that would be somewhere here. And we can continue a little while longer. And that looks pretty random, right? Now it looks, well, so I put down 3 points here. If you actually plot them on the screen while this process is running, you're going to see some points that will lie something like this. And that is, of course, entirely misleading because clearly you can see on this list here that if I go ahead and list all possible pairs of random numbers, then they're actually just going to line up neatly on lines like this. And so it'll look, so it jumps here at 10, and then the next one is over here. I get something like this. So I'm not initializing anything randomly. I'm just putting the particles on hyperplanes, and in this case, for my little silly generator here, I actually just get 3 planes. And this is, of course, trivial. You can already see here that it comes out for this sequence, and it's nothing more than saying that this is just a linear relation, I or y equal to ax plus b, right? But it seems obvious. For some reason, when I take A equal to this, C equal to that, and M equal to that, then it's not so obvious, right? And in particular, it's not so obvious if you put points in a three-dimensional system. And that was not realized for a long time, but if I use this generator that's built into C for putting points in a hypercube, then I get something that, well, it doesn't really matter. I believe the number is about 1,600 hyperplanes in 3D. Of course, it'll have precisely the same probabilities or properties as my simple one here. It'll just look like it's doing something better. And that doesn't quite suffice. And so this is a well-known problem today that people realized, what we're going to be using these random numbers for is actually probably taking two of them in pairs or three of them in pairs, and then relying on the fact that they're entirely uncorrelated. So some of the tests here that I mentioned, they would check for this, and of course these random number generators would fail in that case. Beware of these things. Then we look at this, and then we say, let's switch on the hairdryer. We're going to have to do something that's a little bit more clever. And so one can do something which is sometimes called a Fibonacci generator. So what you would do is that you would take some low-quality random number generator like this one, generate some seeds, and then come up with a secondary process which would be unrelated. And so here, for instance, I could say that I could get one random number here, and I could get it by some operation. So let me just, where I would be combining the two previous ones. In praxis, this operation here is limited to either plus or minus or something like an XOR. If you start to do multiplications or divisions, things get too slow here. I think the current state of the field is that this is currently out of fashion, and it's cousined here where we do something that's called a lagged Fibonacci, where I get Ri from a random number generator, where I look r steps behind, and then combine it with a random number generator or random number that's s step behind. Then that's sometimes called a lagged Fibonacci, and for a while in the mid 90s, then this was quite fashionable. But I think today people are going away from using these. You can define what's sometimes called inverse congruential, or you could get the idea that if I look at something like this, maybe I could do a quadratic congruential where I would square that number. But as I already told you, if you had to multiply something, then things get slow. So that has people have gone away from that. I just want to mention that what is done today quite a bit is ideas that are based on what are called twisted GFSR, so I think that's general field shift register or something like this, where I get my IK and I get it from an idea which is similar to this one. So I look back and then I do an XOR, so this is my XOR here, between two numbers. Now, this here is a 32-bit integer, and that is a 32-bit integer. Now, what I'm going to do, which is different from what I do up here, is I'm going to take this 32-bit integer, and then I'm going to hit it with a binary matrix. You could think that, so this is sometimes called a twist here, and that's because number theorists and mathematicians got involved in this, and you can show that the period, you can get that up quite high if you do this, and still, in order to do that, you can choose a binary matrix here which is sufficiently simple that the application of the matrix here can be done very, very efficiently. A very common generator used today is called the Mersenne twister, and that does a version of this one. So it has an added-on wrinkle to what is done here, and you can go and look it up on the internet. It's called a Mersenne twister because it can be shown that the period here is some power of 2, and the version that is often used as 2 to the power 199.37 and then minus 1. So the Mersenne prime numbers are a sequence of prime numbers that are all of the form 2 to the n minus 1. And so it's called the Mersenne twister, because it applies a twist of this one and then an added wrinkle to that. And quite a few of the simulations that you'll encounter in today that are being published are done using this algorithm. It's a couple of Japanese guys that developed this one, and they have some improvements on it that are called well, for well-equilibrated, long-lived something. I can't remember. I think that's from 2006, and that may be, they claim that it's faster and better than this one, and 2 years from now, then there's going to be something that's even better. So it's something that's in very rapid evolution, and people have really put a lot of effort into today making sure that the random number generators. So these random number generators would certainly pass all the tests that I alluded to before. Yes.
How do you encounter stuff like that? Because if you have a 2 to the power of gazillion, then the computer cannot do so large integers based upon what we have learned.
Yes. Yes, that's right. But what I'm talking about here is the period. So when I looked at this one, I said that there would only be, you know, there's only going to be 2 to the 32 random numbers, right? Okay. But the period can be larger than that. So that's the trick. Here, in for this very simple form, the period is, because once I here hit a number, then everything repeats. If I start doing something like this here, then if I hit one number, then since it's based on the 2 previous ones, then there's no reason that the sequence will repeat again. So you can get sequences where you would just be circling around, and the period would be enormously longer than the 2 to the 32 states that you would have. So that's the idea. Then, you know, if you really get into this, then there are things that I'm worried about, because they can some of these random numbers can generators can fall into a slump. They hit a random number that's close to zero, and then you can use number theory and show that they're going to be stuck there for a while and run around and generate numbers that are not as good, until they didn't work themselves out of that hole. And that sort of one critique of this Mersenne twister that did this, they claim is better done with this one. So, but at this point, I think one can let mathematicians worry about them. But just if you use a random number generator, don't trust the built-in ones. Make sure that you're using a current one that actually is has been shown to be pass a number of rigorous tests. The troubling thing is, of course, that your results are going to be looking probably correct. And it's only if you work for hours and hours, then you realize that the error bar is actually more than 2 standard deviations away from what it should be. Okay, so I want to mention a few other things here. And we now assume that we have gotten hold of one of these algorithms. They're actually fairly small, so it's not a huge code, right? And then we divide by some number,
So we assume here that we have access to what I'm writing as uniform numbers on 0 and 1. And as I just showed you, you should probably worry about, is 0 inclusive or not, or is 1 inclusive or not, and so forth. I'm not going to worry about the details here now, because what I want to talk about now is ways of generating non-uniformly distributed numbers. And if I could generate numbers that would be following any distribution of my choosing, I'm going to show you probably tomorrow that I could solve a number of really interesting problems. And that turns out to be a relatively hard problem. But for the simple cases, it's not too too difficult here. Let me start here with an example here. So let's do a little example. Suppose I have a some numbers that are distributed. So I have a random variable here, and it's distributed with f of x. Okay. So then I ask the question here. How is y here equal to x squared distributed? And that might be a problem that you looked at if you remember what you did in probability theory. So I can look at the cumulative function here for y, and that would be the probability that the stochastic variable y takes on a value that is less than or equal to little y. Okay. And if y here is equal to x squared, then its probability that x squared here is less than or equal to y. So what does that mean? Well, it would mean that the random variable x here, it actually falls between minus the square root of y and plus the square root of y. And that, if I know the cumulative function for the random variable x here, let's call that f x here of plus square root of y here, and then minus f of x of minus square root of y. Right, so if I know the cumulative function for x, then I can find the cumulative function for y, and then I just need to differentiate with respect to y here, so I can see that the density for y here, it's just 1 over 2 square root of y, and then f of square root of y, and then plus f of minus square root of y. So it would seem that I can start modifying these distributions as I like. So let me show you then the first trick that we can do here. I suppose that the cumulative function is known for some density here, f of t dt, and that would just be the probability that, if we look at it, that random variable take on a value that is less than r. And then I assume that the inverse of S is known, and or the inverse of the cumulative function is known, and then I do a little trick here. So I write an algorithm, and the algorithm will do two things. It will generate a random number u here, which is a uniform random number between 0 and 1. And that's probably going to come out of one of these random number generators that we just talked about. And then what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to calculate x here, which is the inverse of u, or f inverse of u, right? And then we need to consider how is x distributed. Does anybody know how X is distributed? Do you know this trick? Well, let's look at it. I'm going to look at the probability here that X is less than R. And that's the probability that F minus 1 of U here is less than R. And that's the probability that F of F minus 1 of U is less than or equal to F of R here. But f of the inverse of f here, that's just the probability that our uniform number is less than f of r. And then we think a little bit, right? Because f of r here, that's just a constant. And u here is just a uniform number between 0 and 1. And by the way, the constant here is between 0 and 1, right? So what I'm asking here is the probability that a uniform random number is less than or equal to a constant that's between 0 and 1. And that is just, of course, equal to f of r, right? So, X is distributed with F, if you like F of T, the whatever we put in here, right? So, if I desire a number that is distributed with a probability density f, I just need to be able to calculate the cumulative function and its inverse. Then I can generate them. Yes?
Variable being less than r, less than or equal r. Where does that r come from? Is that really supposed to be x? Or should the integration bound be changed to r and function? Something's funny. Okay. Okay, that makes everything clear. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of these things that whenever you talk about probability theories, then, there's... Yeah, I'm always struggling with... sometimes I try to make the capital X here to be... Okay, I hope this is clearer, right? Yeah, it's one of these, do you want to, yeah, okay. So that's what we are, this is the cumulative function, and that's its inverse. And what I hoped I proved you, to you here is if I apply the inverse of the cumulative function to a uniform random number, then I actually get a transformed non-uniform number, which is distributed according to F here. There's a famous example for how this works. Then there's an even more famous example where it doesn't work. Let's just do an example two here. We want numbers that are distributed with a density e to the minus x here when x is bigger than 0 otherwise. So that's what I would call the exponential distribution. In this case, with usually you would see it with a lambda in front, but here we're just assuming that lambda is equal to 1. Then I go over and look at this, and then I look at the cumulative function here. So it's f of x here, and then it's the integral from 0 to x of, call it e to the minus t dt here. And, that's just 1 minus e to the minus x. And this one I can, of course, invert. So when I look at s here, which is equal to f of x, which is equal to 1 minus e to the minus x here. Actually, I guess if I follow, maybe I should call it, let's call it u here. I said u equal to f of x here, which is 1 minus e to the minus x here. That means that x here is equal to u minus 1. Then I take the log of it, and then I take a minus, right? So this should now be distributed as f of x. And you can almost guess them. So if you see something with where I take a uniform random number and then a log of it, you can automatically guess that there's going to be some exponential in there. Is there another distribution that we always do in physics or in any field with some exponentials? Yeah, so a Gaussian. So would this be good for a Gaussian? Then the integral of the Gaussian distribution is the error function. And then we have to look at the inverse error functions. This becomes problematic. This we can do for these settings, but it's not so great for Gaussian numbers. Gaussian numbers, one way of getting them is from what's called a Box-Mueller algorithm, and there's some interesting mathematics to it, but I'm just gonna state how it would work here. So you would generate two random numbers. Let's call them U1 and U2 that are both uniform between 0 and 1. And then you, what you get here is then also two random numbers, y1 here, which is minus 2 log u1, and then the square root of that, and then a cos of 2 pi x2, and then I get a y2 here, which is minus 2 log u1 here, and then a sine 2 pi x2. I actually get two random numbers here. There are ways of also generating Gaussian numbers efficiently. But you can see that problems now start to occur, because it would seem that if you look at some path integral that you've defined, and you want to look at the exponential of the action in that path integral and interpret that as a probability density, which you sometimes do when you do quantum Monte Carlo, then things are no longer obvious, because if you want to get the cumulative function, then that would be tantamount to actually doing the entire path integral. One would have to do other things. And the good old von Neumann actually thought about this for a while. A lot of the ideas here came out of Los Alamos in the late 40s. And a number of very notable mathematicians worked on this problem. So von Neumann, ever ingenious, he came up with a method that will always work. And it's called the von Neumann rejection method. The only cut, actually, so if you look at this, then I could show you the mathematics for this, but what you can see here is that it involves a cosine and a log and a square root. So this here is relatively slow, and if you want to generate Gaussian numbers fast, then you would go through versions of the rejection method that I'll tell you about now. So actually, maybe I'll do that over here. So I have some density that I desire to generate, and maybe it looks something like this. So that would be the desired f of x. And we assume that it's well defined here. And maybe it's defined on an interval from A to B. So what you do is you take a box and then you put it around it. And then you do something that's very simple. Let's call the height of the box here M. So now I'm gonna write out the actual algorithm for doing this. So I generate a U here that's uniform now on the interval from A to B. Actually, let's call it X. So it's a uniform number along the x-axis. Okay, then I generate another uniform number that is uniform from 0 to m. 3 here, then I assume that I actually know the function f of x that I desire to calculate. So if y here is bigger than f of x, I go to 1, 4, else here, I return x. So it's difficult to give sort of a really mathematical proof for this. It's sort of you just stare at it for a while, and then you realize that obviously this here works. So let me just make a little drawing here. Suppose that I generate a point here, which would be x1, and then I go up here, and then I generate a y1 here. So this point here, that would correspond to the x1, y1, and that's what we would call a hit. But if I now went out to this point here where I maybe have an x2, and then I actually generated a y2 up here, so I was looking at x2, y2, then this would be a miss. And you can see that clearly the probability for falling below this curve here is going to be given by f of x. So that's the idea. Basically, it's very simple. I'm just generating uniform numbers on this box. And then I'm exploiting the fact that if my random numbers are truly random, then I should simply get a probability for being below the curve, which will be proportional to f of x here. So when I look at this, I can look at the probability of generating what's called a hit here. It's not a term from popular music, but from probability theory here. So what would it be here? Well, it would simply be the integral here from a to b of f of x dx, and then divided by m over b minus a. And then, of course, if that one is this one integrates to 1 here, then this here is 1 over m times b minus a here. This is just the ratio of the two areas, and then clearly you can see that if I took m to be way up here, then my efficiency would go down, and probably I should try to take the m down so it would be as close as possible to the top of the probability distribution if you happen to know analytically where that top is. The great virtue of this algorithm is that it's very fast and it's very simple, and it works in almost any case. So you can actually modify it. So a version of this would be generating Gaussian random numbers that would be faster than this one. So let me then just show you at the end here today. Let me just show you then we get clever, and then we say, well, I showed you that I could generate random numbers with this analytical method if I knew the inverse of the cumulative function. Can't I sort of combine it with this one? So I can do what is something sometimes called an analytic rejection method. How would that work? Well, again, we would have some function. Maybe it would look something like this. And that would be our desired f of x. And then, again, it's defined on an interval here from a to b. And then I have another function, a probability function that I know how to generate random numbers with. Let's assume that I take that density and then multiply it with a constant a. And that's, of course, because these have to be densities, so the integrals have to be equal to 1. And it's possible that your known probability density, in order to get it up above the other one, I would have to multiply it with a constant a here, but that's not going to set us apart. And so basically, then I'm going to do precisely what I did here, but I'm going to assume that my box M here is actually A times GX. So the algorithm for doing this is I would generate a U here on that's uniform between 0 and 1 here. And then I would calculate x here, which would be the number, or you know, I apply. So here we assume that g minus 1 is known. So I can generate numbers that are distributed according to g of x. Okay. So what do I do with this one? 3 here. Then I just run my standard rejection method here. So I generate now a y here, which is between 0 and a times gx. And then so 4 here, if y is bigger than f of x here, then I start over again, so I go to 1. 5 here, I return x. So I can bend the shape of this box here if I can generate numbers that are distributed according to g of x. So you can make quite some way. Yes?
Would it be feasible to do it that way? Surely the function evaluation takes processing time as well. Like, would just bare benignment.
It's a trade-off. This would sound like maybe that would not be the a clever way of doing it, but in practice, this bare von Neumann is quite useful, because the only case is, imagine a function that we very sharply peak, then you're going to have to take m here up to something very high, and your hit ratio is going to go way down. If it looks like something what I've drawn here, it would not make sense to try to be clever like we do here, because as you say, calculating and coming up with g minus 1 of u is probably going to be too expensive anyway. You just need straightforward hit-miss on it. So you have to take these things into account. So now is a good time to stop. So my plan is I'm going to try to tell you how Monte Carlo works, and I want to do that by talking about something very concrete. And that is, we want to evaluate an integral, and we did that for some of the tutorials already with clever methods like the Romberg and trapezoidal and whatnot. We're now going to do something that is a lot more brutal, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. But it's very concrete because it's just evaluating an integral. And then once we've thought about that, then we're going to see maybe I could actually use that in a very clever way, and that gives rise to the Monte Carlo method as it's used in statistical physics and in a lot of different fields. So that's the plan. And then I think for the tutorial Friday, you're actually going to do a couple of integrals with this Monte Carlo method. Okie dokie. Questions at this point? There's a reason why I talk about this in a little bit of detail, because as I'll show you tomorrow, if we could actually solve this problem, which looks very benign, right? I'm just taking some random numbers, and then I'm going to say, I just want to modify them slightly, so I get a non-uniform distribution. Turns out to be a very hard problem. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay.